In chapter 7, we viewed the whole canvas. Now in chapter 8, we're given a detailed description of one section of the canvas. It's rather like walking through an art gallery, and chapter 7 is that vast picture that fills the whole wall, drawn, as we've said, in broad brushstrokes, perhaps in an impressionistic style, to give a general picture of the whole of human history. But then the next painting on the wall is much smaller, much more detailed, much finer in its brushstrokes. And here in this second one is portrayed one part of the history of the first canvas, and as we've said, in much finer detail. So while chapter 7 surveys the whole sweep of human history, chapter 8 focuses in on one part. Chapter 7, if you like, sets up the scaffolding against the building which is human history. And in chapter 8, we make our way up to one section of that scaffolding to survey a portion of the facade so that we might understand it in more detail. In chapter 7, the binoculars take in the whole of the horizon in this broad sweep. But in chapter 8, we zoom in on one part of that horizon and we see some of the detail. And the message? The message of Daniel 8 is quite simple. God knows. That's the message. While it is true, as we have seen, that he withholds most of the knowledge of the future from his people, he does choose, sometimes, to reveal more than just the general picture. He can, of course, show us everything of the future, if he wants to, but he's chosen not to, for reasons that we've already seen. However, from time to time, he will take a portion of history and reveal in the most startling and remarkable detail exactly what he's going to do. And that is what happens here in chapter 8. I want to show you three ways in which this is unraveled in chapter 8. And this week we're going to be looking at the history, and next week we will seek to make the application. I did try to do it all in one go, but I think we'd be here for more than an hour if we tried. So we'll split it into two. Three things then about this history, this more fine history. First, God knows the detail. God knows the detail. As we come to chapter 8 and read the story, we are immediately confronted with a difference. Difference between chapter 8 and chapter 7. While the language of chapter 8 is still pictorial and symbolic, the symbols and the pictures are much, much less bizarre. So the picture itself is much more realistic. Instead of monsters with iron teeth and trampling across the earth, we have a ram and a goat and simple horns. Instead of these enormous sweep of human history going backwards and forwards and depicting mighty things in the heavens, the Ancient of Days and the Son of Man, now in chapter 8 we come down to some real nitty-gritty, some detail. The strokes are less broad, the colours are less vivid, the scene is less surreal. We're getting now down to something specific. The first picture that emerges in the chapter is in verse 3. It is a ram. The second is in verse 5. It is a male goat. And it's worth noting that in the context of Hebrew thought, rams and goats depict human power and leadership. For example, in Ezekiel chapter 39, verse 18, God says, "You shall eat the flesh of the mighty, drink the blood of the princes of the earth, of rams and lambs, of goats and bulls." So the rams and the goats are representative of the princes of the earth and of the mighty there in Ezekiel 39. Or in Zechariah chapter 10 and verse 3, similar usage of rams and goats. Zechariah 10:3, "My anger is kindled against the shepherds, and I will punish the goatherds, for the Lord of hosts will visit his flock, the house of Judah. The shepherds and the goatherds there are the leaders of the people. So when we come to this ram and this goat in Daniel 8, we are immediately recognizing figures of authority and power. But we have much more detail than that. The ram, verse 3, with its two horns, represents the combined Medo-Persian Empire. Now we're told that specifically in verse 20, aren't we? The ram which you saw, verse 20, having the two horns, they are the kings of Media and Persia. So here is this ram with two horns. Horns, as we've seen from chapter 7, representing kingly power. So the ram, which represents authority, has two horns of kingly power. The first horn, we read about in verse 3, is the horn of Media. I lifted my eyes and saw, and there, standing beside the river, was a ram which had two horns. And the two horns were high, but one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. So we've got two horns, and one horn is higher, longer, greater than the other. The first horn is the shorter and the lower horn. That's the Median kings. The second horn is the higher and greater horn. That's the Persian kings. And when we actually look at the history of the period, we find that it was indeed the Median kings who established the kingdom initially, but then it was the Persian kings who overpowered the Median kings and took control. So these two horns, the smaller and the greater, the smaller coming up first, the greater coming up second, depicts exactly how the Medo-Persian Empire progressed. His power is described in verse 4. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no animal could withstand him, nor was there any that could deliver from his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. This is exactly what happened. The Medes and the Persians came from the east, and they progressed west, they progressed north, and they progressed south, through Mesopotamia, into obviously Palestine, Israel, Syria, Egypt, and they dominated the whole area. It was the mightiest empire of its time. So that's the Medo-Persian Empire, depicted in verse 3 and 4 through this ram. Then we come to verse 5, and we're confronted with a goat. And this goat comes from the other side. He comes from the west. So whereas the ram came from the east, the goat comes from the west. And we're told exactly who the goat is in verse 21. The male goat is the kingdom of Greece. The large horn that is between its eyes is the first king. The kingdom of Greece and its first king, obviously, Alexander the Great. And this is exactly what happens. Alexander does move from the west, coming from Greece, obviously, to the west of this region, heading east, and between 334 and 331 BC, he overcomes Darius III of Persia and becomes ruler of an empire stretching from Greece to India. And this is the account given in verse 6. This great male goat with the mighty horn, Alexander, he came to the ram, verse 6, that had two horns, which I had seen standing beside the river, and ran at him with furious power. And I saw him confronting the ram. He was moved with rage against him, attacked the ram, and broke his two horns. There was no power in the ram to withstand him, but he cast him down to the ground and trampled him, and there was no one that could deliver the ram from his hand. Therefore the male goat grew very great. But when he became strong, the large horn was broken, and in place of it four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Remarkable detail given there in verse 8. Having swept from the west, taken over the whole of the Medo-Persian kingdom in a mere 3 years, ruling an area spanning from Greece to India, suddenly at the height of his power in 323 BC, Alexander dies. And his empire is divided between four generals. Notice how that's described in verse 8. The horn was broken, that's the death of Alexander. And in place of it, in place of Alexander, four notable ones came up toward the four winds of heaven. Alexander's kingdom was split between his four generals and divided amongst them. And all this detail about the Medo-Persian kingdom and its 2 centuries of power, and then the Greek kingdom and its shorter period of power, all of this is revealed to Daniel many years before the events take place. Look at verse 1 of chapter 8. In the 3rd year of the reign, King Belshazzar. That's when the vision came. Who is King Belshazzar? King of Babylon. Ruler, along with Nabonidus, of the vast Babylonian Empire. The Medes and the Persians have not yet come. And yet Daniel knows exactly what the Medes and the Persians are going to do. And Daniel knows what's going to happen 200 years later when the Medo-Persian Empire ends and the Greek Empire arrives suddenly under Alexander. How is it that Daniel can understand all these events so long before they take place? The answer is that God knows. God knows not just the broad brushstrokes, not just the general picture. He doesn't just know the generality of what's going to happen. He knows the detail. He knows the particularity of everything. And as we've said, if he wanted to, he could reveal to us the whole course of human history. He could tell us every detail of our lives before it actually happened. Because God knows the detail. That's the first message here as we look at this picture. Second message, God knows the depths. God knows the depths of distress to which his people will have to go. He knows the pain and the sorrow and the heartache that his people will have to suffer. And this is depicted for us in verses 9 to 12. Let's follow it as things get even more detailed and more specific. Verse 9, out of one of them came a little horn which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. Now, of course, as soon as we read little horn, we're reminded of the canvas of chapter 7, aren't we? We're reminded of what we read in verse 8 of chapter 7. I was considering the horns, and there was another horn, a little one, coming up among them, before whom 3 of the first horns were plucked out by the roots. And there in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking pompous words. So in chapter 7, we've already come into contact with this little horn. This one that seems small, and yet poses the greatest threat of all. And in particular, the little horn is concerned to destroy God's people. We noticed that in chapter 7 verse 25, didn't we? He shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and law. Then the saints shall be given into his hand. So according to chapter 7, there is always going to be a little horn, either present in the world or coming to the world. And this little horn will particularly blaspheme God and try to stamp out God's people. In the New Testament, he is spoken of as Antichrist, against God and against God's people. And we're told there will be many Antichrists through the generations. Now, when Daniel had this vision of chapter 8, he was ruling under Belshazzar, and it's pretty clear that Belshazzar was one of these little horns, wasn't he? It was Belshazzar that we saw in chapter 5, who had his great feast and desecrated all the vessels from the temple and mocked and ridiculed God in that way. Belshazzar was a little horn, and there have been many little horns, and there will be many little horns right up to the last times. But here in Daniel chapter 8, remembering that we're looking here at detail of one particular portion of history, the little horn that is being spoken of here is a man called Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. You'll never forget that. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Now this Antiochus was the ruler of one of the 4 kingdoms that came out of Alexander's conquest. We've read about the conquest of Alexander in verses 5 to 8. But the great horn, Alexander, is broken, and in his place, verse 8, come up these four other kingdoms. Now the four kingdoms originally were Macedonia and Greece under the general Cassander, Thrace and Asia Minor under Lysimachus, northern Syria, Mesopotamia and the east under Seleucus, and northern Syria, Palestine and Egypt under Ptolemy. That's the division of Alexander's kingdom, this whole region, into these four areas. And the area that is focused on in verse 9 is the Seleucid area, northern Syria, Mesopotamia and the east. And Antiochus was ruling this Seleucid region in the 2nd century BC. More detail of all of this, by the way, is given in the book of the books of Maccabees, which are in the Apocrypha. And this Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, he campaigned in Egypt against the Parthians and, of course, against the Jews. And that's what's described in verse 9. This little horn, which grew exceedingly great, he moved towards the south, that's Egypt, towards the east, that's the Parthian region, and towards the glorious land, referring, obviously, to Israel. And in verse 10 we're told that this little horn, Antiochus, decided particularly to fight against the people of God. It grew up to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and some of the stars to the ground and trampled them. Now the host of heaven can of course refer to the angels, but in the context of chapter 7 and chapter 8, it seems clear that it refers to the saints, to the people of God, those who will rule in heaven in the last days, as we've read in chapter 7. So Antiochus declares war on God's people, the Jews, and he devastates them, he destroys them, he ruins them. As we read in chapter 7 verse 25, the saints shall be given into the hand of this little horn. And this period of persecution during the 2nd century BC was particularly terrible and devastating. It's described in verses 11 and 12, we'll read it again. He even exalted himself as high as the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifices were taken away, and the place of his sanctuary was cast down. Because of transgression, an army was given over to the horn to oppose the daily sacrifices, and he cast truth down to the ground. He did all this and prospered. What Antiochus is doing here, and it's depicted for us in various historical accounts, he is desecrating the true religion. He's desecrating the people of God and their temple. Look at the detail again, verse 11. He exalted himself as high as the prince of the host. In other words, he made himself like God. By him the daily sacrifices were taken away. He banned the sacrifices in the temple. He actually banned the practicing of circumcision, the keeping of the food laws, the offering of the morning and evening sacrifices. All these were finished by Antiochus. The place of the sanctuary was cast down. The army was used to oppose the sacrifices, verse 12, and truth was cast down to the ground. It's fascinating in the accounts how Antiochus made even the reading of the Bible illegal. Truth was cast down to the ground. He made the reading of the law illegal. It was illegal to worship God, illegal to keep the Sabbath. In fact, Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes went so far as to offer pig meat as a burnt offering to his pagan god Zeus on the very altar of God in the temple. Of course, pig meat was unclean according to the food laws of this time for the Jews. He took an unclean sacrifice, sacrificed it on God's own altar up to a false god. The situation for the Jews was devastating. Their villages were desecrated, their women were raped, their whole lives were ruined. And all this took place in the mid-2nd century BC. What is the message? The message is this: God knows the depths. God knows how hard it is going to get for his people. If the Bible is nothing else, it is a book of reality. It faces up to the truth. The Bible is no Disney story. It doesn't paper over the cracks or pretend that everything is a bed of roses. The Bible tells it as it is. As Oliver Cromwell put it when he spoke to the man painting his portrait, as the habit of the day was to paint the kings and the rulers as being actually quite glorious and beautiful. That's why all these portraits that you see of kings and rulers are really a lot of nonsense. They didn't look like that at all. But Cromwell pointed out to the man painting his portrait, paint me warts and all. And as you look at Cromwell's portrait, he's a pretty warty and unpleasant looking man. That's how he was. And that's how the Bible is. It's warts and all. It's painted as it is. There's no airbrushing stuff out here. There's no sticking the photograph into the computer and getting rid of all the blemishes and making everybody look brighter than they actually are. God tells it as it is, and God knows the depths to which his people will have to go in suffering and difficulty and hardship. It's repeated from verse 23, and we'll just read it because it is a repetition of what we've already had. Chapter 8, verse 23. In the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their fullness, a king shall arise having fierce features, who understands sinister schemes. His power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy fearfully, and shall prosper and thrive. He shall destroy the mighty, and also the holy people. Through his cunning he shall cause deceit to prosper under his rule, and he shall exalt himself in his heart. He shall destroy many in their prosperity. He shall even rise against the prince of princes. Antiochus is indeed a perfect example of a little horn, an antichrist who sets himself up against God and his people, and as long as he is allowed to rampage, the depths of suffering of God's people will be terrible. God knows the detail then. God knows the depths. But thirdly, we learn here from Daniel's vision, God knows the deliverance. Verse 13. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that certain one who was speaking, how long will the vision be concerning the daily sacrifices and the transgression of desolation, the giving of both the sanctuary and the host to be trampled underfoot? And he said to me, for 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. The cry goes up, verse 13. It's an inevitable cry. How long? You've shown us the detail of what is going to happen. You've taken us to the depths of the suffering that your people will have to endure. But how long, O Lord? It's the cry of the psalmist, isn't it? In his distress and in his anguish, how long, O Lord? How long will you forsake us? How long will you judge us? How long will we feel your wrath? And the answer is given in verse 14. 2,300 days. Now remember what we've said about this particular vision. This particular vision is interested in the detail. And so I believe that very possibly here in verse 14, we have actually a detailed statement of the duration of the suffering. Let me read to you what Stuart Olliott says. If we consider a year to be 360 days, and most scholars agree that it is wise to do this when dealing with biblical numbers, we find that this figure comes to about 6 years and 4 months. And this figure ties up with what exactly transpired. From 171 to 165 BC, Antiochus IV Epiphanes persecuted the Jews and continued with his abominations. During the last 3.5 years of that period, the temple was used for heathen sacrifices. The Maccabean revolt permitted the temple to be reconsecrated and reopened for the worship of Jehovah, and shortly afterwards Antiochus died. The promise of the end of verse 14 came true. It all happened just as Daniel had previously seen and heard. Isn't that remarkable? It came to pass precisely as Daniel prophesied. It's reasserted, isn't it, in verse 25, as we read at the end of the verse, he shall be broken without human means. Yes, Antiochus, this little horn, this manifestation of Antichrist, he will do his devastating worst. He will drag the people of God down to the very depths, but he will be cut off. At the height of his power, just as Alexander was cut off at the height of his power, so Antiochus is cut off at the height of his power. It's a fulfillment, isn't it, of the symbolic number of chapter 7, verse 25. Evil shall reign for a time and times, and then when it reaches its peak and its pinnacle, half a time. These men will be cut off, and they will be cut off, verse 25, without human means, literally, without a human hand. And it's fascinating when you read the history again that Antiochus died suddenly and without warning in 164 BC. He wasn't even in battle. He just died. God struck him dead. It's fascinating as you follow the history to see that during the same year that Antiochus died, following a successful Jewish rebellion by Judas Maccabeus, whom we've mentioned before, Jerusalem was recovered, the temple was rededicated, and the sacrifices recommenced. The Feast of Hanukkah was instituted, and that is celebrated by the Jews to this day in commemoration of the deliverance from Antiochus Epiphanes in 164 BC. God knows when deliverance is coming. God knows the exact time. God knows exactly how it's going to be done. And most wonderful of all, God is going to do it. He's going to do it himself. It's interesting that here in chapter 8, the Maccabean revolt is not even mentioned. Obviously, Jewish historians are keen to emphasize what the Maccabeans did and how under Judas they rebelled and revolted and overcame. But God says, no, 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 it was me that did it. It was my hand that intervened. I delivered. Don't give the glory to man, give the glory to God. This then is the message of Daniel chapter 8. I've tried to cover the history, giving you sufficient detail to understand how it fits, but hopefully without bogging you down in the detail. Because it's the message that matters. If you go away today and forget all that history, honestly, that doesn't matter. But remember the message. God knows the detail, God knows the depths, and God knows the deliverance. Now, I'm sure in your own minds you're already beginning to apply this to Christ and to ourselves. But we'll come back to that together again next week and see how that is so. All I want us to do as we conclude this morning is to stand back from the picture in the art gallery and just take it in. Hundreds of years before these events took place, Daniel sits down and writes with his own hand the detail of history. Every single detail he writes down is absolutely spot on. From the horns that arise and when they decline and how they decline, to the direction in which the various animals representing the kings and the rulers and the generals move, north, south, west, east, to the time that it takes place, to the way in which each one is overcome, to the detail of how Antiochus brought the temple into disrepute and desecrated the temple and stamped the truth underfoot. He made the Torah illegal. All of this written down to the finest detail. Hundreds and hundreds of years. Daniel is writing in the 6th century BC. Antiochus is around in the 2nd century BC. That's 400 years. And he knows it all. He's not bragging about it. Verse 27, he's terrified by it. We've already seen that, haven't we? He's not saying, aha, I know, I'm the great prophet. You know, come and listen to me, I'll tell you what's going to happen. No, he's specifically told to hide it away. The purpose of prophecy is not to satisfy our curiosity, or, as we've already seen, to put us in a position of power. We know what's going to happen. No, it's to communicate to us that God knows. He knows the detail. He knows the depths. He knows the deliverance. Was it not the same with the coming of Christ? How is it that right at the beginning of human history, in Genesis chapter 3 verse 15, straight after the fall, God says, "He shall bruise your head"? No. "The serpent shall bruise your heel, but your seed will bruise his head." That's thousands of years before Christ comes. And then you read through the Old Testament and you read, "He shall be born of a virgin," hundreds of years before Christ comes. "He shall be born in Bethlehem," hundreds of years before he comes. "He shall heal the sick, the lame shall leap for joy," hundreds of years before he comes. "His body will be broken, but not a bone of his body will be destroyed. He will hang upon a tree. He will be spat upon, vilified. He'll be accused of blasphemy. He will die, and he will rise again on the third day," hundreds of years before it happens. How can God know all of this? He knows it because, as we found, the message of Daniel in every single chapter and verse is the same, really. Our Lord is sovereign. He knows all things because he controls all things. So the question to close is simply this: is Daniel's God your God? Because if he is your God, then you can put all your trust in him. And you can live your life no matter what happens, knowing that he is in control. He controls the details. He controls the depths. And best of all, he controls the deliverance. It's in his hands. Amen.